Axis Mundi.
Welcome to One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew L. Seidel, a constitutional attorney and the author of The Founding Myth and American Crusade. This is a podcast about religion, the law, and the battle for America's soul. We'll be separating church and state, defending freedom and equality, and fighting Christian nationalism. If you haven't already, sign up for our weekly bonus content and ad-free listening at accessmundi.us. LFG, folks. Welcome to One Nation Indivisible. Kristi Noem is out. We've got a lot to cover. There's a lot that happened. Kristi Noem is out. The Supreme Court did some stupid shit. And you've heard talk of Armageddon in Iran. We've got things to cover. We're going to get to all of it. Kristi Noem is out. Let's celebrate that. It's wonderful. Marquanye. I'm not sure how you say that first name. As people have pointed out, he can't secure the borders between his first and middle name. But Marquanye Mullen is now going to take over Noem's position. He is uneducated. He is terrible. He is a brawler. I do not like him. But what I will not do, and what I would like to not see you folks do, is make fun of him for, as I've seen some people say online, you know, cowering during the January 6th insurrection. And I don't want to, I'm not trying to finger wag at anybody here, but I don't want to play into the idea that January 6th was not a serious violent threat to American democracy. I mean, a violent mob was chanting about hanging legislators and breaking down the barricades and attacking the Capitol and trying to overturn a free and fair election. And as I've explained to y'all, I've watched almost all that video. From that day. And I can tell you that a few seconds here, a few seconds there, you know, a brave police officer not doing this, dumb luck, you know, the mob not knowing where they're going here, there. I mean, this was, we were so close to seeing a member of Congress die that day. And this was a serious assault, and treating that moment like a punchline plays into the folks who are denying not just the election, but also the violence and the threat of that day. There are plenty of reasons to dislike Marquanye Mullen, but his behavior on January 6th is not one of them. In fact, it's maybe the only thing about him that is not fully MAGA. Afterward, he visited police officers who had been assaulted in the hospital. He talked about how one of them had lost their eye. His eye had literally been gouged out. He talked about the attackers and said they had evil intentions. They had evil in their eyes. And he's defended, at least rhetorically, the officer who shot Ashley Babbitt, saying he was, you know, fighting for American democracy along those lines. So I just want us to pause. He's terrible, but he's not terrible for what happened on January 6th. And also note that none of this applies to Josh Hawley, who raised his fist in solidarity with the insurrectionists only to run away from them later. I do think we can and should mock him mercilessly for that. And I, again, just to be clear, Mullen is still a big defender of Trump, obviously. And those are probably the last uncritical things I will ever say of him. And my point is not that we shouldn't criticize him. We should, just not for what happened and not for his response to January 6th, not for his actions that day. Go after him for being a grifting insider trader. He's making a ton of money using his congressional power and status and knowledge, insider knowledge, to enrich himself. That seems pretty clear. He's a short little man who wears high heel boots and stands on risers to make himself look bigger. I mean, he's going to run ice for fuck's sake. Like, not a great guy. Let's just not play into the idea that January 6th was not a serious violent threat. I mean, this is the guy who said, this is my point, there's so much to get to criticize him for, to mock him for. I mean, this was a guy who said when Oklahoma was trying to force teachers to force the Bible on students, Mullen said, kids should be taught the Bible, quote, but I want it to be taught by someone that was taught the Bible themselves, too. I think it's a slippery slope when you put it in the hands of teachers who may not be believers. That's going to be teaching the word that can easily be taken out of context. In other words, he doesn't want the Bible taught. He wants the Bible preached as truth by Christians who believe it to be true. Right? Not teaching. Preaching. Indoctrination, not education. That's what he wanted. That's what he was after. And he was smart enough to know that if you put non-believers up there, they would point out, for instance, hey, the Bible does not say that Mary was a virgin. It's the best translation, the scholarly translation, is that Mary was a young woman, Alma, young woman. And therefore, I mean, that's the kind of thing you would expect to be taught in a school if we're teaching the Bible from a scholarly standpoint. If we're preaching it, they gloss right over all that. So, please, by all means, go after this guy. But if you are talking about and you're showing that picture that is going around of him behind the seats on the floor of the House, I believe it was, and mocking him for that, let's just take a pass on that one. Get one of the other things. There's pictures of him on the debate stage standing up on a little riser. Like, you know, there's all kinds of fun stuff you can do. Find the quote that I was just talking about, you know, preaching the Bible in public schools. Hit him for those things. The insider stock trading, big one. And I think with Noam and all this, I think there's one other question that I don't know the answer to. I mean, I think I have an idea of what the answer is. And it's, will we see any kind of shift in ICE's behavior after this? And I don't mean to suggest that because Stephen Miller and Donald Trump suddenly think that what ICE is doing is wrong. But it has been wildly unpopular. There's no denying that. We have won the messaging war on ICE. People are completely pissed off, soured, hate it. Trump's numbers on immigration they are utterly tanked. We know from reporting that he is unhappy about all of this. And they have a chance here to kind of hang all of that around Kristi Noem's neck and let the door hit her on the way out. You know, they could talk a good game, for instance, and they could do some small changes, some cosmetics things that might win back a good chunk of that support. Like, that's what I would do if I were them and still trying to be terrible. I don't know if they have the discipline to do that. I don't know if Stephen Miller cares to do that. And that is another piece of this question, I think, which is the independence of Mark Wayne Mullen. And what I mean by that is it has been clear from the beginning that Stephen Miller is directing anything that touches on immigration from the White House, that he is essentially the president when it comes to immigration. Donald Trump is his bitch. So was Kristi Noem. The question is, will Mark Wayne Mullen, who, again, is not an educated man, not a man who has any history in law enforcement, isn't like he's some sort of brawler, will he be willing to bend over and take orders from Stephen Miller? Who, I mean, technically doesn't really have much of a say in the constitutional order of things. Or is Mark Wayne Mullen going to stand up, or is he going to be Stephen Miller's bitch? I guess that's the question. I don't know. Feel free to tweet it at him and ask. I don't know the answer to any of those things, but I know that we are unlikely to see any real policy shifts. And I know that once you empower a bunch of bullies and you tell them that they can act without fear of accountability or retribution, that they will abuse that power. I mean, it's inevitable. This is, you know, I remember learning, I took AP psychology in high school, one of my favorite classes of all time. And we learned about the Stanford prison experiment. And, you know, this is just normal people who are given unlimited power over another group of people. And they turned into monsters. I mean, really pretty quickly. And I, you know, it's the same kind of thing with ICE. You're effectively seeing, and these people were probably not normal people necessarily already, right? They were probably already scraping the bottom of the barrel, already bullies, you know, the worst people you know in high school, given a gun and badge, and unchecked power. It's like, I mean, imagine the Stanford Prison Experiment. And if you're not familiar with this, go have a ball. Like, go down that rabbit hole. Enjoy Wikipedia. Like, go have some fun. I mean, it's not fun. Go have some enlightening reading. And then think about what that experiment would have looked like if, you know, the ICE recruiting campaign was done to populate the guards, the people who became the guards in that prison experiment, and what it would have looked like. I mean, there was just a report that I've not been able to fully read, so I'm not going to say it's true, but I believe it was Mother Jones published, I saw the headline, about ICE in an ICE facility betting on which inmate, for lack of a better word, in the concentration camp would kill themselves in the next day. They had apparently a betting pool, like your Super Bowl squares going. Again, go read that for yourself. I have not had a chance to yet. Awful. So even if there were changes coming from the top down, that's not enough, because the infection is also at the bottom. This is a fish that's rotting from the head, the tail, the fins, fucking everywhere.
The Fed's out of options. Rate cuts, money printing, balance sheet reversals. They call it policy, but it's really panic. This is in-game economics, where hope replaces discipline and the illusion of control finally breaks. They're not cutting rates because things are strong. They're cutting because the system is cracking. Inflation's eating savings. The labor market's stalling. Confidence in the dollar is fading fast. For decades, the Fed built a house of paper. Now they're striking the match that could burn it all down, leaving you to pay the price. When's the last time you actually held the wealth you've spent your life working for? My friends at Noble Gold Investments have been helping Americans move from paper wealth into real tangible assets. Numbers on a screen can disappear, but physical gold and silver, they've outlasted every crisis in history. Visit NobleGoldInvestments.com and get your free wealth protection kit today. That's NobleGoldInvestments.com for your free wealth protection kit. Discover how simple it is to protect your future.
Past performance may not be indicative of future results. Investing in precious metals, including gold, involves risks. Consult with your tax attorney or financial professional before making an investment decision.
Okay, let's talk about the Supreme Court and its case Mirabelli v. Bonta. Mirabelli is the shorthand that we're going to be going with. This was a case that came down on March 2nd after we recorded the last episode. And it involves a set of California law and policies for public schools. And parents challenged those policies as a violation of their religious freedom and their due process rights. But we're going to focus on religious freedom for now. And the facts are vague. They're not entirely clear. There was no argument. There was sparse briefing before the Supreme Court because this was a shadow docket decision. This was on the emergency docket. And there was no emergency. But deciding cases on the emergency docket means the justices can decide these fundamental issues, these fundamental constitutional questions, the wrong way without really ever having to explain themselves. And then they can chastise lower court lawyers and judges for not understanding the law that they have in their heads and just expect all of us to follow. It's bullshit. The way they decide cases on the shadow docket, we've covered it before, covered it in American Crusade. It's awful. There's a whole book by Stephen Vladeck about it that's amazing. It's called The Shadow Docket. The court is doing this for political reasons. And the only silver lining that could possibly exist is that hopefully it makes all of the Supreme Court precedent that's coming out of this court weak for the future. But the policy at issue in Mirabelli basically says that if a student wishes to do anything that is inconsistent with their gender at birth at school, then the student must consent before the school is going to inform the student's parents. In other words, the student gets to choose the terms of their parents knowing this about them. To quote from the law, it says public schools employees, quote, shall not be required to disclose any information related to a pupil's sexual orientation, gender identity or gender expression to any other person without the pupil's consent, unless otherwise required by state or federal law. Okay. Sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression, any other person. So they just have to consent. And the parents in this case are arguing the opposite. They're arguing, no, you are required by law, school, teachers, teaching assistants, janitors, any school official, coach, you are required by law to tell us anything that is inconsistent with what we think our students' sexual orientation should be, what we think their gender identity should be, what we think their gender expression should be. And this is a really weird argument to me, because like, how do you not know? Right? Like, how do you not? And the answer here is obvious. It's because you're such a God-fueled tyrant that your own child can't be honest with you about who they are, because your child fears telling you, fears neglect or abuse or worse. So instead of the state just being able to stay out of what I think they would otherwise consider to be a family affair, these parents would otherwise consider to be a family affair, the Supreme Court here, can you guess the fucking lineup, said, no, the state must take the parents' sides affirmatively and always. And you probably need to go back to the Mahmood case, which we covered in episode 19 or 20 on this podcast. It was on one of those Sidelines podcasts. It was a Supreme Court roundup, so it was not on the regular schedule. It must have been around June. To cover some of the Supreme Court cases. And in that case, in the Mahmood case, it was a religious freedom challenge to classroom materials, like books that don't conform to the religion of some parents. And the same 6-3 conservative supermajority in that case on the captured Supreme Court basically gave religious parents a veto over things in the classroom that their God doesn't like. And I believe I pointed this out before, but I mean, it's not really things that their God doesn't like, right? It's the things that men say that their God doesn't like. And yes, it's always men. It's not things that the holy book says, not what the God says. It's what men say God says, what men say a holy book says. If those men say it, then those parents can keep it out of the classroom. That was the Mahmood case. And the court blew that up even more in Mirabelli. So I'll quote from the operative opinion, quote, the parents who assert a free exercise claim have sincere religious beliefs about sex and gender, and they feel a religious obligation to raise their children in accordance with those beliefs. Sidebar, what's the thing about fuck their feelings? I can't remember. Continuing the quote, California's policies violate those beliefs and impose the kind of burden on religious exercise that Yoder found unacceptable. That was the Amish case. Go back and listen. We can talk about that more. Go read American Crusade. Continuing the quote, indeed, the intrusion on parents' free exercise rights here, unconsented facilitation of a child's gender transition, is greater than the introduction of LGBTQ storybooks we considered sufficient in Mahmood. I abbreviated a little bit there at the end. So they're saying this is not just the kid doing something and the school like staying out of it. The justices are saying that is the unconsented facilitation of a child's gender transition. And, you know, when this decision came down, again, shadow docket, so kind of like one of those middle of the night things. I always think of the worst shadow. Sorry, another tangent on the shadow docket. The shadow docket is why COVID and the pandemic dragged on for so long. After Ruth Bader Ginsburg died and Amy Coney Barrett was shotgunned onto the court during that election, all of a sudden, the Constitution changed and there was a religious freedom right to be exempt from public health and safety laws. And churches could now meet in violation of all common sense, the health and safety and well-being of other members of society. And it was on the Wednesday before Thanksgiving at around midnight, I believe, that decision came down on the shadow docket, changed course. The court had never said before that. It was always 5-4 against that right, and I'm just fucking unbelievable. Okay, anyway. So when it came down, there wasn't a lot of preparation. People were not ready. Our side was not doing a good enough job talking about it. And people were trying to scramble to kind of read the opinion and explain what happened. And some folks were saying, oh, look, this is forcing the teachers and the school district and officials to be snitches. But it's way, way worse than that. It makes teachers and public school officials into enforcers of religious orthodoxy. They're like the religious police now. Christian nationalist religious police, effectively, in our public schools. And Ian Millhiser over at Vox, and I will share his article in the show notes, did a really great job of kind of explaining some of this and asking questions that teachers are now going to have to struggle with and try to figure out answers to, or be violating the religious freedom rights of parents. So here's Ian, quote, if a male student paints his nails, or if a female student wears a traditionally masculine article of clothing, such as a necktie, must their teachers race to the phone to inform the student's parents? Does gender incongruence include dating a member of the same sex? And if so, what if a teacher observes ambiguous evidence that a student is gay, such as witnessing two female students holding hands? If a member of the drama club performs in a way that lampoons gender roles, does the Constitution force the student to inform their parents? And then Ian points out, and I think this is the place that my mind went immediately, and I think that is key. Forget about the gender and sexual identity, sexual orientation, gender identity, gender expression for a second. That is awful. But imagine that the students behave in other ways that conflict with the parents' religious beliefs. Quote, are teachers required to inform on Orthodox Jewish or Muslim students who eat bacon in violation of their parents' religious beliefs? If parents send a student to school wearing a headscarf, a kippah, or a cross necklace, do teachers have a constitutional obligation to inform the parents if the student takes it off? And again, what happens if the student is gay? If a teacher learns that two male students are dating, do they have to immediately call the parents in case those parents object to homosexuality on religious grounds? So this is going to be a disaster. And it's going to be a disaster for public schools, public school officials. And again, that's also always, 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 always part of the point of the Christian nationalist movement. It is to erode and destroy public schools, both the quality of them and the inclusiveness of them, so that kids are forced out and forced into the only alternative, which is usually a Christian school. I mean, this is a big part of their goal. And, you know, kind of public schools are sort of the last bastion of church-state separation. And now we're talking about making teachers into religious police. And I want to go back to American Crusade and what I tried to point out in there, because I tried to predict some of the fights that were going to be coming. And that was published 4 years ago now, which is kind of crazy. I can't believe that. But I talked a lot about this conflict of parental rights, which is a phrase that was invented essentially by one of the guys who ran the Alliance Defending Freedom and the Homeschool Defense Fund, Legal Defense Fund, Michael Ferris, terrible Christian nationalist lawyer, and also effective, unfortunately. And what he said is, when it comes to religious freedom, this is from American Crusade, I'm going to paraphrase myself a little, we would do better to think of parents as having duties and responsibilities to children rather than rights over children. And so a lot of the cases that came up in there and that I see coming down the road and that I saw coming down the road can be humanely resolved by treating children like people with their own rights, including self-autonomy and health. Government telling parents how to raise their children it's a huge and fearsome boogeyman in our collective mind, in the American culture. And it's really justified in some communities, black and brown communities, indigenous communities. Like, there's good reason to be fearful of the government telling you how to raise your kids. And the Supreme Court has touched on this fear and talked about it. And that is really the only reason that these cases are harder sometimes, but that doesn't make them impossible. And it doesn't mean that when a young life is incapable of caring fully for itself, religion can impose on it things which the adult would not consent to. Responsibility for kids does not imply impunity. You know, and one of the things that I pointed out throughout the book was that parents do not have unlimited rights over their children. Then I used the Abraham getting ready to sacrifice his son Isaac as a hypothetical, which has been a popular hypothetical in law. Parents don't have a right to risk the life or safety of their children because they believe their God commands it. A parent who beats a child should be punished, whether or not they believe their holy book says that if they don't beat their kid, they're going to spoil their kid. Parents who neglect the health of their diabetic child, leading to that child's death, should not be exempt from homicide and neglect laws, even though that's the case in some states. The law cannot allow children to be sacrificed on the altar of religious freedom. The law must be the arresting hand that stops Abraham from plunging the knife into his son, not the legal sanction for murder. And it's not even that hard in this case, in the Mirabelli case. Because, again, the school is basically saying, like, hey, we're staying out of it. It's not our responsibility to police your kid on this stuff, parent. If you need to do that, that's up to you. But they're free to do what they want while they're here with us. I'm betting some of you disagree with that. Hit me up. Hit me up on social if you do. One more big thing and then a few small items to cover before we part ways. Some of you probably heard the story about how troops were told that the Iran war was meant to bring on Armageddon. I have not seen something go so viral in quite some time. It happened a week ago, as this podcast goes to publication on Tuesday. The original story was posted on Monday by an independent journalist, a guy named Jonathan Larson, who I've worked with in the past, known for a decade. He has done some really phenomenal work on things like the National Prayer Breakfast. I respect the hell out of his work. I think he does good stuff. However, he is an independent guy working on his own Substack. Doesn't have an editor, doesn't have fact checkers. He's doing his own thing. Not a problem. And I'd be willing to bet many of you shared this article. I heard about this from just about everybody. I was getting texts from former interns, DMs from all over the place. And I had some serious reservations about the story, and I still do. And I'll try to explain some of them, but I want to point out that Hemant Mehta, who has been covering this stuff for 20 years and is a friend and is somebody who I really, really respect, wrote an excellent Substack later on, you know, after this story had flown around the world 100 times. Check the show notes and please, please, please read it. The title of Hemant's story is "Before You Share That Story About How Troops Were Told the Iran War Is for Armageddon, Read This." There were a couple of things that Hemant covers, and again, highly recommend reading it. And I'm not going to criticize Jonathan Larson here. I don't think he did anything wrong. I think he's reporting. He's reporting off of a independent complaint from a group called Military Religious Freedom Foundation, MRFF. According to Murph, the press release that Jonathan Larson was writing about, they got, you know, many, many, many complaints about commanders saying the war in Iran is to bring on Armageddon. And this, of course, makes a huge amount of sense, right? And the part of my brain everybody has that part of their brain that loves to say, "I told you so," right? That's the part of my brain when I saw the headline first where I was like, "I fucking told you so." You know, on here, we've been covering what's happening at the DOD, in the military with Pete Hegseth. The minute Pete Hegseth was named, we knew that Christian nationalism was going to be running rampant throughout the military, right? He's got Crusader tattoos, Deus Vault. He wrote a book called American Crusade that's like, he's actually arguing we should do that instead of mine, which is actually arguing like this is a big fucking problem. We knew this was going to happen. So the part of my brain that is like, "Oh, I told you so." But, you know, whenever I feel that way too, I also feel a little bit of an obligation to kick my skepticism into high gear. And the reasons that I was skeptical about this story were that the numbers reported from MRFF were very, very high, as though this was a very widespread problem. This was not a single one-off individual. Many, many reports of this. And there was no independent corroboration anywhere. None of the other groups that do this kind of work had publicly stated that they had had any kind of report. Not a single journalist. This story was covered everywhere, but not a single journalist verified anything beyond what Murph was saying they heard. Okay, so there was nobody, still now, a week out, nobody has heard from a member of the military saying this story is true, beyond MRFF saying they heard from somebody. Even though there were all these other groups out there doing this work, all those other groups hear from members of the military all the time, and journalists hear from members of the military all the time, right? Like, this is the kind of thing where, you know, you get a recording, you feed it to a reporter, you call a reporter, tell them about it. Like, there are many, like, these kind of things do not stay secret. And yes, I think people in the military are rightfully probably paranoid right now, and maybe are more scared than they have been in the past about, you know, maybe contacting a member of the media. But there's still folks, there's no independent corroboration about what happened. And that is a huge, huge, huge red flag for a story this big. And that was just kind of the first red flag. I would encourage you to go read Hemant's story because he points out some other things, including the language of the report that Murph made public, which is a sanitized email at the very least, but also appears to be nearly identical or very, very similar to other emails that have been reported to MRFF over the years. Things like this are happening in our military. That doesn't mean this one is true. It doesn't mean it's not true. I had a lot of red flags, and none of those have been fully assuaged as we have moved deeper and deeper and farther away from this story. There are other things than Hemant raises that I would encourage you to go read. Mikey Weinstein, who runs the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, and Hemant talked. So there's Hemant recaps some of that conversation at the end of his piece. I would expect additional reporting on this, but again, if you shared that story, I think you owe it to yourself to go fully read Hemant's piece on it. Okay, we've got a few other things to round up before we end for the day. The Evangenitals are going after James Tallarico because James Tallarico won the Texas primary. And once upon a time, he said that God is non-binary. He used a word, Tallarico used a word that they like and a word that they don't like in the same sentence. And so they are big mad, the Evangenitals are. And, you know, it just strikes me, my God, they're obsessed. Right? I mean, between kids playing sports, women playing sports, public bathrooms, and now the penis of the Christian God, MAGA are just... they are just obsessed with everybody else's genitalia and what's being done with those genitalia. I mean, this is the same party that proposed those laws requiring the genital exams of children so that those kids could play sports. Remember, I think it was Ohio HB 151 maybe that required, maybe a couple years ago, that required genital inspections before kids could play sports. I mean, it is insane. It is insane. And you know, props to Tallarico for one, for winning, and two, for, I mean, this, I actually think this is like some really kind of brilliant trolling in a way. And I think he's a very effective messenger. And I have had people ask me, you know, do you, Andrew, like, he talks a lot about his faith. Are you worried about that? Do you think he's going to go Christian nationalist once he gets in office? And I don't. I don't agree with him on everything, including some of his takes on Christian nationalism. I think Christian nationalism is very much Christian. Maybe I'll try to get an interview with him sometime and we can dig into it. But I also think he talks about the separation of church and state in ways that I really, really appreciate, and is taking it to an audience that really, really needs to hear it in Texas. And defending that principle in ways that I truly appreciate. I am not worried about that. I will be doing all I can to help him get elected. And I think we'll probably bring a friend on, Will Judy, who's a really brilliant political activist down in Texas, who maybe can give us a little bit more insight as that race kind of ramps up. Okay. Two more. And I'm not going to say much more about this. In fact, I'm not going to say, I'm just going to read you the headline. And then, opinion. This is an opinion piece from the Washington Post. Quote, why America needs evangelicals on the Supreme Court and more. And I just, I mean, y'all, the subhead is the lack of evangelical Christians at America's most prestigious institutions fuels mistrust. Oh my God. This is idiocy. I mean, it's shockingly, glaringly, stupidly wrong. And it's a mark of how far the Washington Ghost has fallen. It just is. It's sad. No mas on that. And then lastly,
we are honored to come before your presence today, lifting up the arms of our president. We pray for your continued blessing and favor to rest upon him. We pray for wisdom from heaven to flood his heart, his mind, and Lord, you will guide him in these challenging times that we're facing today. I pray for your grace and your protection over him. I pray for your grace and protection over our troops and all of our men and women serving our armed forces. And Father, we just pray you'll continue to give our president the strength that he needs to lead our great nation as we come back to one nation under God, yes, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. We pray your heavenly blessing upon him in Jesus' name.
Amen.
So that was the prayer in the Oval Office. You probably saw the... God, it was just such a gross moment. I mean, it's really just... The ick is thick. I mean, we're talking... I think it was about 20... preachers, many of them laying hands on Trump, trying to lay hands on Trump. I think there were like two women, maybe one person of color there. So, you know, 85% white. Really, okay, terrifying. We are at war with Iran. And you have our Secretary of State and this Marco Rubio, who also has all these other holds all these other positions in the administration, including, you know, national intelligence type positions, saying, quote, Iran is run by lunatics, religious fanatic lunatics. I mean, and then cut to that scene in the Oval Office with these people putting their hands on Trump and praying. Not only do they have access to power, crazy amount of access to power. I mean, Paula White is in there and she's working in the White House. You know, I mean, they're no doubt assuaging that man's conscience among many other awful things as they all gather together. It is harrowing. And if I am another country watching as Rubio talks about religious fanatics, as we start a war that nobody can explain, there's no plan to get out of, we have no idea, we're bombing girls' schools, which now has been confirmed. I didn't mention that last week because it was unconfirmed. And killing students, little girls, for no fucking reason, other than apparently to distract possibly from the Epstein files, because it seems like there's no other reason we could be doing this. Who are the religious fanatics? Who are the lunatics? Next week, folks, My guest is going to be the inimitable, the amazing, the voice himself, Seth Andrews. My buddy Seth Andrews is going to join. We were chatting on the phone the other day, and I was like, wait, you haven't been on the podcast yet, man? And so he's going to come on, and we're going to chat. I don't know what we're going to talk about. We're going to have a little fun, probably. Can you have fun these days? Yes, you must. You can and you must. Hang in there, y'all. Seth Andrews next week, then a week off while I am on the Free Thought Cruise. And then back to our regularly scheduled program, though I have been talking with Brad about rethinking the podcast entirely. So if you've got thoughts, send them my way. Much love. Never forget that life is too good to waste on bad ideas.
This has been One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew Seidel. Until next time.